Cassette number 7. Father John Paul talks to us about our attitudes towards self, others, God, and the world.
It seems that this bus tour was going through a town in England, and the guide said, "And now we come to the famous town of Runnymede, where the Magna Carta was signed." And this American lady aboard the bus said, "When was it signed?" And the driver, tour guide, said, "At 12:15. "Oh," she said, "it's 12:30. We just missed it." What I'd like to talk about is ideal attitudes today. But before we do, I'd like to summarize what I've said. I think that what the attitudes up in the head are the place of conversion. If I was trying to aim at anybody, I'd aim at the attitudes. And I think Jesus did that in the Beatitudes. These are the B-attitudes. These are the one of B, these are the attitudes you have to have. And I've often thought that if there is a place of conversion, it's the mind. It's the mind and all those attitudes and that frame of reference or that vision of reality that everybody has. Now, what we said was that you inherited, by osmosis, you inherited those attitudes from your parents. That largely your parents were the ones who breathed those attitudes into you. And you accepted them because you had no answers. You came into this world a bunch of questions, and they gave you the answers. But in defense of parents, I have to say what I have already said. I'd like to repeat that you didn't hear what they were really saying, and that all depends too on the order of children, your age order in your family. It depends too on a lot of things. Like I have an older brother that I've never understood, and I still don't understand him, and I don't think we can ever be close. And a psychiatrist came through Chicago. I try to siphon off all the wisdom I can from these guys. And I said, "Tell him about my brother." And I said, "He was the firstborn male. He looked Italian. He had curly black hair like John. And he had flashing eyes. He had my father's first name, William. He was a favorite child. And he's turned out, I would guess, the least well-adjusted of the children in our family. And he was never nice to me. I can't remember that. Maybe he was." And the psychiatrist said, "Oh," he said, "that's a lot of responsibility to put on a little kid. To tell him you're the favorite, you're the one that's got to come through. You're the one we're counting on." He said, "That's a terrible responsibility." And he said, "And beside that, if he's 2 years older than you, you took his mommy away from him." And I said, "What?" And he said, "Well, can you imagine a two-year-old who used to have center lap and get all the coochie coos, and now he doesn't anymore? And he's watching this new kid sitting in his mother's lap, and he resents him." And I asked a psychiatrist friend of mine, "Could that still be in my brother?" And he said, "Yeah, without a doubt. Without a doubt, there's still some kind of jealousy, resentment of you that goes way, way back." So these are the attitudes that we collect in our minds. And there's no use blaming anybody, because if you use that word blame, or you want to lay a guilt trip on anybody for attitudes, it'll slow the whole process of recognition down. You can't blame your parents, because I don't know if I heard what they were saying to me. Maybe I misinterpreted, and children are notorious misinterpreters. They say if you want to know if a child really heard what you were saying, you've got to employ what they call shared meaning. Repeat back to me what you just heard. "Do you know I love you?" Like if you tell a child not to cross the street, one child might say, "You really care about me. You don't want me to get hurt." Another child might say, "You don't want me to have any fun, do you? The other kids down the block can cross the street if they want to play in the street. But you don't want me to have any fun." So you never know what they're thinking. And you've got to ask them to repeat back what they heard, if you want to make sure that they really understood what you were saying. So what I would like to suggest is that you got your original attitudes from your parents. The things that they thought were important, you thought were important, and so forth. You were kind of a carbon copy. But remember, you did not hear what they were saying exactly. it's what you heard that counts. And as they say in communication, it's not what you say to someone else, it's what they hear that counts. And it's what you heard that lasted. Then you took those original attitudes to school with you. And they were modified somewhat by all of your experiences. And when you're young, I think you don't believe that. You don't believe that a lot of the residue of parental attitudes are still in you until you get older, and then you say, oh my goodness. You know what I do? I used to laugh at my dad who did this, but he would personify inanimate things and then swear at them. Pencils, light bulbs that won't screw in, pencils that roll off your desk, and when I find myself doing that, I laugh. I go, oh my goodness, my father did that. But a lot of times as you get older, you begin to see in yourself the same mannerisms, the same attitudes, surfacing for recognition that were in your parents. But at any rate, you do modify them by your own experience, and you come around to a set of attitudes. Now, we said the crippling attitudes, the ones that are stifling to you, the ones that paint you into a small corner of life, will show up somehow in the form of pain. And you can either become a blamer or an owner. And a blamer blames his pain on someone else or something else and says, if the leaves were blue, I'd be all right, but they're not, they're green. Or this person in my life is driving me crazy, this place bores me. And the real answer is, oh no, happiness is an inside job. And an owner says, what's in me? Why do I feel that way? And tries to gradually get in touch. And this is the process of self-psychoanalysis, of dredging that unconscious, of getting up those attitudes to the surface for recognition. And then you can change them. But you got to recognize them first. You got to know why. I feel guilty whenever I say no. I don't feel generous. One of the things that I have personally come into contact with is to trust my own inner judgment. I don't. I naturally always was attracted. I look back in my life, I was always attracted to people who were sure of things. And there are some people who are sure of everything. But I was always attracted to them because when they said, this is true, then I believed it was true. But I wouldn't trust that inner judgment of my own. And I'm trying to teach myself now a new attitude, to trust my own inner judgment, to go with what you think. At any rate, I think an owner, I'm trying to be an owner, does that. Trying to realize, what does it mean to be a phony? And by God, for better or for worse, I don't want to go to the Lord and have him tell me that I put on a good show, that my life was a charade. I want to be real. But I want to accept the fact that these causes are inside me. And I can change them. I can change them by counter logics. I can change them by modeling, by finding someone else, and just knowing that there are alternate attitudes. You often hear people say, well, that would have driven anyone crazy, and I go, oh, no. It would have made anyone mad. No, not true. There are people, do you know, in this world that can't get angry? They really can't. There are people that always interiorize blame. They say, it must have been my fault. They take the blame for everything. There are alternate attitudes, and there are healthy attitudes out there that you and I can explore the brains of the minds of those people who have them and then try them on for size, to introject their attitudes into ourselves and try them on. And gradually, through counter logics and modeling and stretching and praying and positive imagining, we begin to take on those other attitudes. But it's a slow process. It's not a sharp corner you turn. But the clarity of insight with which you see you're punishing yourself can cause you to act differently. For example, I told you about how I was the Messiah, how I wanted to help everybody, wanted to pour myself out just helping everybody all the time. But in fact, I was keeping them weak by giving advice, by being the Messiah for everybody, by doing things for people they could do for themselves. That's keeping people weak, so I could get the payoff of having helped them. And once you realize that, you can act differently. You can think your way into a new way of acting, that's true, by positive imagining, but you can also act your way into a new way of thinking. And I refuse to give advice. I refuse to be the Messiah. And then gradually the attitude begins to take shape inside you. But after the clarity of insight, which you realize that was stupid, that was dumb. And through positive imagining, you imagine yourself in situations, you practice on the stage of your imagination, and gradually the attitude changes. It really does. I know for a fact it can change because I used to be shy. And also, I think it's very important to stretch, because you do act your way into a new way of thinking by stretching. You think of yourself as someone who can't give a speech in public, and you give your first speech. And then no one dies, the world doesn't go into a holding pattern, you say, I can do it. I can do it. And then the second time, I'm pretty good at it, in fact. And the third time, maybe I'm very good at it. And the fourth time, I'm comfortable doing it. But you gradually start thinking of yourself differently as someone who can do it. I have a Jewish friend who's an alcoholic. His name is Lee Silverstein. He's written a book called Consider the Alternative to Drinking. And he's Jewish. And he went to his rabbi and said, I think I'm an alcoholic. And the rabbi said, no, Lee, you're not. Jews don't have that problem. And he said, well, if I'm not, why do I feel peaceful only when I'm half smashed in some bar with everybody else who's half smashed? And he said, Lee, you do not respect yourself. That's your problem. You do not have enough self-esteem. And Lee Silverstein told me that until he cleared up that drinking, until he stopped drinking, he wasn't even able to recognize his own real problem. He was anesthetized all the time. And now he can get at that problem of but he couldn't respect himself as long as he was drinking. But once he stopped drinking, and is a recovering alcoholic and drug addict now, and for the first time in his life, he can respect himself. He can begin to work at what the rabbi told him was his real problem. But contrary to a popular misconception, Jews do have that problem, Lee Silverstein says. Now, what I'd like to talk about in these closing talks are ideal attitudes, at least as I see them. I submit them to you, and you can add or subtract or debate any of these you'd like. But you've got to have an ideal toward which you're working. And what is the ideal attitude toward self? Well, how should you think of yourself? And I'm sure of this, that you've got to be at peace within yourself. If you're not at peace within yourself, and you don't have to accept yourself as a perfect person, because you're not perfect. And if you do, every time you do something dumb or say something dumb, as I often do, you hate yourself. Hey, I'm fragile, I'm weak. But God loves me as I am, and God wanted me to be who I am. When God made the world, you know, he could have made me different. This is the me he wanted me to be. And you got to be forgiving of yourself and make mistakes when you make mistakes. I mean, animals have these infallible instincts, but we don't. We have intelligence, so we have to measure twice and saw once. Sometimes we make a mistake. Sometimes we saw the board too short. So it seems, anyway, that the first act of surrender to God is to say, I am who I am. This is who I am. This is who I'm supposed to be. I'm not supposed to be someone else. And they say that the death of self-image is to compare yourself. They say, oh, if I only had so-and-so's gifts, if only I was as strong as so-and-so, only and that's stupid. You're not supposed to be so-and-so. You're supposed to be you. And you got to sit with that one for a long time. If I really believe that when God created me, he had me in mind, he wanted me to exist, and he knew all these weaknesses. And as I get older, I'm beginning to see that I really can't judge myself. When I go to confession, I submit whatever I have to, insofar as I'm guilty, but I really can't judge. I don't know all the messages that are stored in my brain. Remember that 10-story computer that covers the state of Texas? Oh, my goodness. I really don't know. Like when I found out about my brother and the favoritism that is so costly to the kid that is the favorite, and that you take his mother away from him. And then all of a sudden I said, whoa, that's still on his brain? He wouldn't believe it, by the way. I'm sure he would laugh and say, oh, come on, you and your psychology. But I think it's true. And I don't know, maybe things like that are on my brain. Things like that force me into certain things. And so what I have to set out to do is to grow, not to be perfect. I'm not perfect. I never will be perfect. But I can grow. And a lot of times you don't see yourself growing from day to day. But it's something like a ship out at sea. If you look at it at one time, then you look at it the next time, a year later, you see that maybe it's just moved, huh? And you have moved. And I'm a little more humble than I used to be. I'm a little more grateful than I used to be. I'm a little more this kind and thoughtful of others than I used to be. That's growth. And that's all God can expect of me. I like to say that it's okay to be weak. It's okay to be human. Don't worry about it. I'm okay. You're okay. That what God sees is the intention, not the performance. Everybody else rates you according to performance, you know. Do you produce? Except God. God says, hey, I know what you want to be. And you'll get there someday, but slowly. It's okay to be weak. Now, everybody always balks at this and says, oh, gosh, if you say it's okay to be weak, don't you stay weak? And the answer is no. That's when you begin, when you accept yourself as weak, that's when you begin to grow. If you remember the image we used of the cylinder and the psychic energy coming up through the center of the cylinder, if you don't direct it, if you're struggling with the self-doubt, you have that civil war going on inside you, it's not okay to be weak, I ought to be perfect as my Heavenly Father is perfect, you know, the energy siphons out on all those stupid things, your worry and guilt and all those tyrants that are inside us. But when the person is at peace and that energy has a sweet flow to it of love, love of self, love of others, love of God, that's when a person begins to grow. So I really think instead of having the expected effect of saying it's okay to be weak, it's okay to be me. It's all right to struggle, and I look for growth, and I am growing slowly. I'm more wise than I used to be, more humble than I used to be. That's growth, and that's all God can expect. If I resent that I haven't reached perfection, then I begin to worry about it, I begin to feel guilty about it, and then I use all that energy I could have used for growth, I use for self-destruction. Eric Fromm says that energy that is not used for a purpose, is not sublimated, will turn into self-destruction. And that's exactly what he means, that cylinder. All that energy coming up will be used, when it's used for guilt, when it's used for self-condemnation, when it's used for self-doubt, self-derogation, is wasted. It's energy you could have been using for loving, for having an enjoyable life, for enjoying life, you use for self-destruction. So the ideal attitude towards self then would be that I'm a fragile human being. The human condition is weakness, and I am weak. I am a wounded healer and a hospitable host. I'm me. I'm trying to be real. And I look for growth and not perfection. And ultimately, I think you have to find peace within yourself. Peace is the, I'm me. I'm all right being me, even though I'm weak. Peace is the key, to a good self-image. When you're at peace within yourself. What is the ideal attitude toward others? I remember there was a prisoner in our state penitentiary in Illinois that I used to go visit. And since he was in for life for attempted murder, he'd been in jail, out of jail all his life. And by the way, he always said that every time he did a job, he always left some clue that the police would catch him. And he said, I didn't mean to do that, but I did. I can see by hindsight. And at any rate, when I would go down there to visit him, if you've ever visited someone in a state prison, oh, man, it's an awful experience. They search you, and they x-ray you, and they put you through mechanical doors, and you have to sign your name about 15 times to get in. And then the prisoners that are violent have waist belts around them, big leather belts around them, and then handcuffs built into them, and two trusty buff trustees have their hands locked in those handcuffs, and the man has his hands handcuffed behind him. And it's the whole attitude is one of distrust. And I was going in one time with an old black lady, and she was helloing everybody. She was going to visit her grandson, who was a prisoner there at Illinois State Penitentiary. And she was so kind and so loving. I said, wow, you must bring a lot of joy into this world. And she said, oh, Father, she said, I'm a Christian. And she said, there are no strangers in my world. They're just brothers and sisters, some of whom I haven't yet met. And you know something? I really believed her. She treated people that way, that they were brothers and sisters. They were not competitors. They were not out to get her. They were brothers and sisters, and she was kind and loving. And I, whoa, you really believe that, don't you? Oh, yes, I do. And I think that sometime do this. Take a test. In your experience, how have you found people? People are. And then put down the first 10 things that occur to you. And don't bother to be too cerebral about it. Just the first 10 things occur to you. People are what? People are generous. People are selfish. People are no good. People are out to get me. People are whatever. But that rapid completion of that sentence, what are people in your experience? And the first thing I put down when I did that was needy. People are needy. Almost everybody I know is needy. And what they need is affirmation and the sharing of myself without manipulation. They need to believe in themselves. They need to know who I am. But at any rate, put that down and go through that. How did you get to your attitude on other people? Well, mostly from your parents. It's really interesting that there's a girl at school who was talking to me one time, and she's real paranoid. She's, oh, I thought everybody was out to get her, you know, and everybody was talking behind her back, and when she'd see two people talking over in a corner, she knew they were talking about her. And I asked her, which of your parents is paranoid? You got to learn this from somebody. And she said, oh, my father. He's always talking about how people are out to get him. And we do that. When I have a class at school, I say, are there any real worriers in this classroom? And I don't mean half-baked worriers. No, I want real ulcer jobs. Anyone a worrier? And about 5 kids raise their hand. I'm a worrier. And then I say, now look, I don't know your parents, right? And they all say yes. But one of your parents is a worrier. Do you know which one it is? And they all shake their heads. Yes, they know which one it is, or both of them. Because they had to be taught how to worry. That this is the appropriate response when things go wrong in life. You worry. So I think I quoted Lee Salk, the brother of Jonas Salk, who invented the polio vaccine, when he said that the smartest thing a kid can do is make a wise selection of parents. And it's true that if your parents had healthy attitudes, and in general you got them, remember you didn't hear exactly what they were saying, you're off to a great start in life. But especially with regard to other people, what did your parents say about other people? Did they distrust them? Did your mother say, did they send us a Christmas card last year? Wipe their name off the list. You know, you give only what you get. I baked a cake the other day, and I gave half of it to Mrs. So-and-so, and I'm baking donuts today. I smell them, and she didn't send any to us. But you get your attitudes this way, or your father comes home and talks about the people at work. And you're a little kid playing with your toys, but you're taking it all in. And you have to now, I think, ask yourself about other people. Who are they really? Now, what I'm convinced of is that there are two people inside of everybody. And a loving person draws out the loving person. The good person draws out the depth. You look past the weak and foolish things you couldn't help but dimly see in me, and you saw the good and beautiful belongings, and you drew them out of me. When you're a loving person, you draw the goodness out of people. When you're an angry person, you draw the anger out of other people. You draw the hurt, wounded, defending type person out of that other person. One of the things that I learned slowly, I came from a seminary to teach at Loyola, and when one of the kids would say, I think this religion is a lot of garbage, I used to want to level the kid. And then I would say to myself, I've got to straighten this kid out in front of everybody so everybody, this atheism isn't contagious. And then I began to think about it. Why does that bother me? Why don't I feel sorry for that kid? And what I realized, trying to be an owner, was that the kid stirs my doubts. If he's right, I'm el stupido numero uno. If religion's a lot of garbage, if faith isn't real, I'm really dumb. But also, I think everybody, no, I don't think anyone believes 100%. And I begin to wonder when I hear him say that. And my anger is not really directed at him. It's a displaced emotion. I'm really angry because I don't want my doubts stirred up. And so someone once said to me, you never get anywhere in a win-lose argument. Because what people do in a win-lose argument is they're trying to win. I often think that parents, married people who argue all the time, are both immature. You're trying to win. You're trying to win so you're right. And what the other person always does in a win-lose argument is try to shore up their side of the argument. And so I think in a sharing discussion, in which I tell you what I feel, and you tell me what you feel, maybe we disagree, but it will widen my horizons to know that you think something else. And I try to see the merit of what you're saying, and I try to share with you what I think and what I feel. In a sharing discussion, everybody wins. In a win-lose argument, everybody loses. And so I think that your reaction to people is really more of what's in you than what you feel about the other person, than stirred up by the other person. I think there are two people in everybody, and I think that you have to love people. You have to care about them. And I see Jesus as exemplifying this. You know, I feel sure that the reason Jesus was killed was that he loved sinners. And he went out to them. And he understood them. You remember that gasp in Luke's gospel? He even eats and drinks with sinners. The sign of intimacy. And remember when the prostitute comes in at the house of Simon the Pharisee and cries over his feet, and Simon's sitting there with the veins bulging in his forehead, says, why didn't he kick her in the mouth? She's a slut. And Jesus says, you see this woman? And he goes, this is a woman. This is a woman. This is not a case. We always try to reduce people to cases, don't we? There's a case of ulcers in room 301. You think you pull back the sheets, you'll find a case of ulcers lying in the bed. What's your problem, we say to people. We try to reduce people to problems. This is a woman. And her sins must be forgiven because she's showing so much love. He doesn't say, I forgave her sins. He says, her sins must be forgiven because she's showing love. Because you didn't do this for me when I came in here. And she hasn't ceased doing this. And so Jesus went out to sinners. And they couldn't take that because Judaism at the time was a religion of legalism. You're supposed to eschew, avoid sinners. And he goes out to them. What kind of a rabbi is he? He won't even interpret cases. So we'll give him a few cases. Master, a good master, now come on, solve some cases, will you? And they finally catch him. We got this woman taken in adultery. We caught her red-handed. Now the law says we should stone her. What do you say, good master? And he starts doodling in the sand. And the old interpretation is he was writing the secret sins of the accusers. And the new interpretation is that he got so bored with the discussion, he started doodling in the sand. Oh, come on. And finally, they come to him and they say, you know, you're soft on sin. Publicans, as you know, were tax collectors who collected taxes from the Jews to send to Rome. And Zacchaeus was a tax collector. He's a little runt. And he wanted to see Jesus just to see him. And nobody would talk to Zacchaeus because he was a gouger. And he was collecting from his own people to send to Rome. He was disloyal. And he got up in a sycamore tree. And when Jesus is passing by, he walks over and says, hey, Zacchaeus, I want to stay in this town tonight. Could I stay with you? What a risk he took, huh? All the people turned. What's he asking Zacchaeus for? Zacchaeus that nobody ever talks to. And Zacchaeus drops out of the tree and recites the Boy Scout oath. If I've defrauded anybody, I'll pay him back double. But that act of love changed him. Now, we don't know that Mary Magdalene was a hooker. We do know that Jesus cast 7 devils out of her. But I think she's one of the greatest women in the New Testament. It was Mary that was out on the road on Easter Sunday morning. It was Mary when the apostles were locked in the upper room, afraid, their knees knocking, their breath bated. And Mary was out there. And she said she thought Jesus was the gardener. She said, if you tell me where he is, I'll take him away. She couldn't have moved him anyway. But love doesn't consider obstacles. But Mary Magdalene had been a sinner. But Jesus loved her in life, and that's what I think we're supposed to do for other people. To let Jesus love them through us. To care about them. To melt them, to change them. And so it's, at least it seems to me that what you got to start out with is changing the attitude toward the ideal attitude that everybody makes psychological sense. If Somerset Maugham says in his book, The Razor's Edge, people aren't just people. People are the genes they inherited. People are the families they grew up in. People are the brothers and sisters they had. People are the schools they attended. People are the old wives' tales they've heard. And people are the God they prayed to. And I think that's true, that when you come into my life, I don't know where you've been. I don't know what's on your brain. But I know you make psychological sense. You're not a bad person. You may be a hurt person, but you're not a bad person. And I'll never help you unless I love you. And Karen Horney says the three parts of love are kindness, encouragement, and challenge. I've got to be kind to you. You've got to know that I'm on your side. If you don't know that, I don't help you at all. And I've got to encourage you to believe in yourself. And I've got to challenge you eventually to use the talent that God has given you. But this is what I think the ideal attitude toward others would be. One of the attitudes that's in our minds and is a very important one is our attitude toward the world. Now, I would like to define the world, if I may, as anything except persons. So your talents, your physicality, your money, deaths, these would all be part of the world as I would define it. You know, in the scriptures, there are two different definitions of the world. Jesus said, I do not pray for the world. The world will hate you. And then he says the scriptures say that God so loved the world, he sent his only son into the world to love it into life. So there are two definitions of world in the scriptures. And as he says, I want to define world. It's everything other than persons. And you've got to ask yourself, what of all those things, Jesus says, don't let them own you. Hey, you're a pilgrim. You're just passing through this earth. Don't dig your stakes of your tent too low into in the ground because you're moving on. Don't ever be owned by anything. I think this is what poor in spirit means, to be detached. Love people, but use things. Now, if you start to love anything like honor, you begin to use people to get it. Money, you use people, you foreclose on them. There was an old man in Chicago who, I won't tell you what he did, but he foreclosed on the poor, and he was a multimillionaire. He was a Catholic. And he asked me one day to come to his house for breakfast, and I was 10 minutes late, and he stood there in the doorway saying, you're 10 minutes late. I know I got lost. And he said, you know, I write my own radio commercials, and a radio commercial is really stunk. They were awful. But he said, how did you sleep last night? And I said, I slept well. He said, I couldn't sleep at all. He said, I was writing a new radio commercial. And every time I thought I had it, it would elude me. I tossed and turned all night. And the guy was 82 years old. And I was thinking, oh, hey, mister, you got one foot in the grave and the other foot on a banana peel. And you lost all last night's sleep trying to think of a new radio commercial that would make you wealthier. And you're worth $150 million. Oh. Hey, mister, you don't own your money. Your money owns you. You are owned. You are possessed. And I see this happening, you know, in a materialistic society. We become materialistic. Things begin to own us. You know, it's really interesting that two-thirds of the freshman class at our university 10 years ago used to go into biology pre-med because money was in medicine. And now, with the lawsuits and everything, law is the big thing. And now two-thirds of the freshman class that are wanting to be lawyers, not doctors. It used to be that there were 8 applications for every place in a medical school in this country. Now there's 1.5 applications for every place in a medical school. It's a lot easier in a medical school now than it used to be. Because the money isn't there. Everything is money. Bill O'Malley from the New York province asked his high school boys, who's your biggest hero? Come on, put down your biggest hero. And you know who the biggest hero, you almost unanimously, of high school boys is? Donald Trump. Donald Trump. Everybody is materialistic, and we have to ask ourselves, do I own things or do things own me? Now, I would like you, as I have done, to make a list of the 10 most important things in your life. If God said to you, look, I want your permission to take away or give anything that I choose, except I'll leave you these 10, what would you put down? Now, I put down, I don't mean to prime your pump at all, or to prejudice you at all, but I put down mental and physical health, the priesthood, and you know what, I put down some other strange things in my choice of 10 most treasured possessions. One was a sense of humor. I couldn't imagine going through life without a laugh, you know? People who take themselves so seriously, especially young people who go around the campus like life is all uphill, I want to tickle them and say, oh, come on. It really ain't that bad. I remember the first girl I ever anointed conditionally was a girl who put a gun up in her mouth and shot herself. And she was about 20 years old, and I looking at her corpse and saying, why did you do that? But, suicide is the second highest killer among young college students today. Accidents are the first. And suicide is the second. And every year, we had 3 suicides at our school last year. And how many attempted suicides were there? You don't know. These people have just given up. So I think, oh, wow, you know, to be able to laugh at yourself and to be able to laugh at life is so important. I put down a good reputation. I think I would find it personally very hard to serve people that didn't believe in me. I would find it hard. So anyway, put down the 10 possessions that you, one old nun said she didn't realize what until she realized her false teeth were very important. But put down the 10 possessions that you would like to save. If you had to leave in the middle of the night, there's a fire, what would you take with you? There's a lady I'm going to see in New York after this is over, or my part is over, who took her kids to Coney Island. And the kids swoop in the door, they're anxious to get out of the beach, and they scuffed a little bit, just a little bit, a BMW that was parked next to them. And this man got furious. You put a scratch in my car, lady. Tell your kids. And, oh, that's a $37,000 car, you know. And he kept screaming and frothing at the mouth. And finally she said to him, hey, sir, you're abusing me. Now, listen, if you want to call a policeman, I'll wait right here. And he did, by the way. He called a policeman. The policeman had to look for the scratch in his car. But it was so important to him, that $37,000 car of his. Was so important. And Jesus says, it's really hard to have a lot of things. It's really hard to be a rich person and get into the kingdom of heaven. Because I know from experience, the more things you have, the more things can break, the more things you have to worry about being stolen, and they preoccupy you. And that's why Jesus said, it's harder for a rich man to get into the kingdom of heaven than it is for a camel to get through the eye of a needle. You know, people strapped all their possessions on their camels whenever they moved. And one story is that the eye of the needle was the name of a mountain pass, and you had to push the camel down on its knees and push it through. But if you had a lot of possessions on the camel, you hardly get it through. And you think about that. Do these things that in my life, do they own me or do I own them? One of the things that really bothers me as a teacher, and I must admit it still bothers me a little bit, was when two people in my class would talk to each other. I'd see two heads together, and I would immediately call on one of them. So-and-so back there, what do you think about this? And I didn't get the question, Father. No, didn't you get the question? Oh, why? Well, he didn't get that word that you just used. He didn't understand what you meant. And I was explaining it to him, and I went, oh, you know, you crawl back in your hole. But I asked myself, why does that anger me? Why does that bother me? And you know what I discovered, being an owner, trying to be an owner anyway, is that I like to power over people. And if I'm not holding you, If you're distracted, if you're talking to someone else, that means I'm not stimulating you. I'm not holding you. I'm not in your conscious mind. I want to be that. You know, when Jesus had the three temptations to power, pleasure, and the avoidance of responsibility, the psychologists say those are the three big temptations of people. Pleasure, power, and the avoidance of responsibility. He said pleasure in the form of, I'll change those rocks into Dunkin' Donuts for you. How about that? All those lights out there, you see the lights that are flickering on and off? No? All those countries are mine, I'll give them all to you, that's power. Now, throw yourself in the temple, let your father catch you. And Jesus said, hey, don't experiment with God's patience. But Freud says that everybody's out for pleasure, everybody. That's the thing that drives us on, libido. And it's been translated sexual pleasure, but I don't think Freud meant that. A libido drives us on, Adler, who they were both Jewish, you know, Viennese psychiatrists. Freud used to say about Adler, who broke away from him, he said, for a Jew boy, he's doing all right. But Adler says, you know, Freud solves everything according to pleasure. And he said, I'm going to call mine individual psychology. And eventually wound up by saying that everybody's out for power. You want to prove that you're not inferior. You want to prove that you're not really what you think you are. And he said, the way you have to prove it is constructively. Write a poem and show it to somebody. But don't tear someone down. Don't gossip about someone. That's negative, proving yourself. Power. Everybody's out for it. Everybody's trying to prove themselves. And in our own day, B.F. Skinner from Harvard says, no, I'm sorry to say, but beyond human freedom and dignity, you're not free, you see. You have been programmed early in life, and your life is like a phonograph record that's spinning itself out. You're programmed. And someone asked him one time, Dr. Skinner, let's say he's written 7 books, I'm not sure. Dr. Skinner, were you programmed as a baby just to write 7 books? He said, exactly, no more, no less. So he really believes that, and then he falls into a little self-contradiction when he says, we've got to get children away from their parents and get them professionally programmed by professional programmers, because parents spoil kids. That's where the trouble begins. But he says, it's all programming, you're not free. And I think back, that's what Jesus was tempted to. And you've got to ask yourself, and I have to ask myself, because everybody is partially right, you know. We are out for pleasure. Some of us are really out for pleasure. And when Freud was asked, well, what about people who live lives of sacrifice, the do-gooders? Well, he said, that's where they get their kicks. That's where they get their pleasure. And then Adler comes along and says, no, everybody's out for power. And Skinner says, no, you're not free. You're programmed. And you got to ask yourself, to what extent each of those has made inroads into my life? To what extent do I abdicate my own responsibility, ownership? To what extent do I say, you made me mad, you did this to me, I feel this way because you forced me to feel this way? To what extent do I do that? Do I avoid responsibility? To what extent am I out for power? To what extent am I out for pleasure? And ask yourself about that. But at any rate, that's the attitude, I think, toward the world. The world of things. Make a list of the 10 things and ask yourself if you own them or they own you. And the final thing I would like to talk about today is your attitude toward God. Now, a Spanish priest named Juan Arias once wrote a book, and you probably have read it, called The God I Don't Believe In. And he says, the God I don't believe in. He wrote it first as an article in a magazine, and a lot of atheists wrote in and said, my God, I don't believe in that God either. That's the God I have rejected. What God do you believe in? But he says, I don't believe in the God who demands 100% in all the examinations, a God who drives you on and on, a God who puts flashes a red light at all human pleasures and so forth. But I have 3 questions I would like to ask. And I always ask people these 3 questions. And now you just say yes or no to the 3 questions mentally. Does God get angry? Does God punish? The second question is, does God punish? And the 3rd question is, if you or I shaped up and we were better people, would God love us more? Would God love you more if you became a better person? Now, my answer to all 3 questions is kind of what I think. If you really understand the answer to the 3 questions, you understand who God really is no to all 3 questions. Does God get angry?
In every audience I've ever talked to, maybe barring the present company, but in every audience I've ever talked to, people say, but the wrath of God is so clear in Scripture. What about Sodom and Gomorrah? And you always get a little flack about this. And I want to say, is it true that emotions arise because of something in us? Is that right? I mean, when you get angry, is it because of something in you? Maybe something not bad, maybe a sense of justice, but is it right because of something? Can you imagine an angry God, a changeless God who is always angry? And if I can make you angry, if I can trot out your goat, that means I have a power over you, doesn't it? Do we really have that power over God? Can we really make God angry? Oh, I can't imagine that. That God is an angry God. And so when the scripture scholars come to these things about the wrath of God, they say, be sure to tell the people that this wrath is not something in God, but a figure of speech. It's called an anthropomorphism, where we attribute what's in man into God. We project it into God, but God isn't angry. God is infinitely happy. And you can't even I can't imagine an angry God over whom we have the power to make angry, that God would get angry over us. Even though it's in Scripture, I think it's a figure of speech in Scripture and not a literal truth. So, number one, I don't think God gets angry. Number two, does God punish? And this is real easy in a college classroom. You say, if you flunk this course and I write F after your name, did I flunk you or did you flunk? And they always say, oh, I flunked. And I said, God will record our performance. But when we sin, it's we that sin. We're the ones that change. God doesn't change. If anything, God feels sorry for us because God loves us. God wanted to love us. And we say, no, you are not going to love me when we sin. And we can leave God. We can lose our souls. But God doesn't punish us. And God may arrange circumstances in our lives to bring us closer to Him that look like punishments, but they're not vindictive punishment. God does not punish. Would God love me more if I shaped up? There's a couple that went into marriage counseling, and the husband was a neatnik. And the wife said to the marriage counselor, my husband's a neatnik, you know. He comes home and gives the house the white glove test, and if everything is in order, then he's real nice to me. But if he isn't, the house is not in order, then he's real cold and withdraws his affection. And the husband says to the counselor, that's right. She's right. I work hard all day, and I deserve a clean house, a well-cooked meal, and well-scrubbed kids, and so forth. And she said, but I need to know you love me whether I can do that or not, in order to get the strength to do it. And the counselor said, oh, she's right, of course. That we need to know that God will love us. And God does love us, unconditionally. When I leave God, it is I that leave God. I change. I grow cold. I grow lonely. I don't know what you believe, but I believe that the flood was a parable. I don't think it literally was true, even though they're still looking for the lost ark. I think what the father was saying to his little Jewish son was that if you leave God, you're going to drown. There's no other alternative. Now, I ask you to think about, please, the parable of the prodigal son, because I think all three answers about God are in that parable. The young boy comes to the father and said, I've had it with the chickens and crickets. I'm leaving this place. I'm splitting. Now listen, oh, take that sad look off your face. I'm a member of the go-go generation, and I'm going to go whether you like it or not, because you, man, are obsolete. You know how to live. Now, listen, Scrooge, you were going to give me some money someday, weren't you, an inheritance? Why don't you give it to me now? And the father asked him, well, son, have you thought about this? Have I thought about it? Every day of my life I've thought about it. Now, give me the money or I'm leaving anyway. So he gives him his inheritance. And the boy goes off to the big city of dark lights and dark delights. And the people coming by pass the little father who waits every night on the cottage steps for his son to come home. He misses him. He wants him home. And the people passing by taunt the little man and say, hey, you should be declared father of the year. You sired a fuzz brain. You should see that kid of yours in the big city. Wine, women, and song. But the father endures all this. And in the meantime, a famine strikes. And the young boy goes to the men he's been buying drinks for. And he says, Could I lean on you? And they say, get out, creep. Get out, creep. Don't you call me creep? Who do you think's been paying these tabs? Get out, creep. And then he realizes when he goes to the women that he's been sleeping with, could I lean on you? He said, what is your name? We don't remember your name. What's your name? And then he realizes, you never loved me at all. You used me. You used me because I had money. And then he remembers his father, how his father always provided a warm a meal and a warm bed for the people that he hired, his hand. And he says to the men and women there in the town, hey, I got to eat, you know, I'm human. And some man says, I got a pig farm. You can feed the pigs on my farm and eat what they don't. Not much, but it'll keep you alive. And he's down there trying to digest these hard husks and tucking the swill up into his mouth. And then he thinks more about his father, his kind and dear father. And he starts home with that half-baked act of contrition. I'm not worthy to be your son. Take me back as a hired hand. At least I'll eat that way and have a warm bed to sleep in. And when the father sees his son come home, he says, oh, here he is. And he runs down the road. And all the scripture scholars say no father would have ever run down the road, no Jewish father at that time and that place, would have ever run down the road unless there was an uncontrollable explosion of joy in him. Oh, my God, the kid is home. Oh, he's home. My boy is home. And he runs down the road and he grabs him and he embraces him and he can feel his father crying. He feels the sobbing in his chest and he says, hey, I'm not worthy to be your son. But the father never hears that. And he clears his throat and he wipes the tears back from his eyes and he says, hey, get out the rings and the robes. Clothe my son in rings and robes and kill the fatted calf and get some music makers in here. Let's start a party. My boy is home. And the party is in full swing when the older boy comes in from the field. And he says to one of the hired hands, hey, what gives? He said, oh, you're not going to believe it. He's trying me. What's up? He said, the kid's home. My brother? Yeah? He's home. And what's all this? That's the part you're not going to believe. Your father wanted to have a party for him. You know the calf we're going to show at the 4-H convention? He killed it. It's in the pits. And the older boy says, you go in there and tell my father I'll never put a foot in that house as long as that kid's in there. And the father comes out to the older boy and he says, what is it, son? He said, you're kidding. Oh, you're kidding. What is it? You asking me what is it? I work this damn farm. You see these calluses on my hands? I earned them. And you never had a party for me and my friends. But now the kid comes home, and I was here the night he left. He broke your heart into 1,000 little pieces. I heard you cry in your bed at night. I saw you sitting on the front stoop of the cottage waiting for him to come home from the town, and people taunted you. It hurt. It must have hurt. And yet, now he comes home, and you have a party for him, but you never had a party for me. And the father says, oh, I'm sorry. I thought you understood. Everything I have is yours. Oh, I love you. But there's something else that you have to understand. It's what goes on in the heart of a father when his child comes home. Now, you obviously know what the fathers of the church wrote, that's the end of the parable. Jesus said, this is who God really is. This is what God really thinks of a sinner. That was the question they were forcing on him. What does God think of a sinner? What does God think of someone who's weak? You got to know what goes on in the heart of a father when his child comes home. That's the answer. That he waits patiently. And a little father is never angry at the son. He lets him go. He lets him be free. But he misses him. He wants him home. And when he comes home, he has a party to celebrate his return. And the fathers of the church wrote that you and I are the older brother in that parable. And they say, can you come in and celebrate with your brother? Can you? Can you come in and accept this kind of a father or can't you? You want to stay out in the cold? And I think this is who God really is. And I think that the answers to those questions are in that parable. Does God get angry? Does God punish? And would God love you more if you shaped up? And I think God is saying, no, you've got all the love I have to offer you. It's true, if you shape up, you can take in more of my love. But I've given you it all.